You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. You're listening to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Thank you for subscribing on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on Himalaya. My name is David Ramil. As promised, I'll be talking about some of the best moments in Miami Heat history, and to help me do that, I'm joined today by a friend of the show, the host and co-founder of the Miami Heat Beat podcast, and the creator of the subtitled podcast and YouTube channel, Mr. Giancarlo Navas. How are you doing?
Wow, dude, you went to the anime channel and podcast. I appreciate that. Listen, that is a labor of love. YouTube and the anime pod are a labor of love, and we are friends here, and I appreciate that plug, David. I am glad to be on the program.
Oh, excellent, man. I during these dark times, it's always a good opportunity to kind of spread your interests around a little bit. And if you've got great content, I clicked on your channel on YouTube. I'll be 100% honest with you. The anime is not my thing.
But your
perspective, always a welcome one. And you know, I know it's a fascinating medium. I have never been one to get into it. I mean, the extent of it is, probably Miyazaki films. That's about as far as I go.
Those are good too, man.
That's not nearly enough, right? I mean, I'm
honestly, I like that people enjoy Miyazaki because while I'm not a Miyazaki fan, I do think a lot of what he does is really representative of what makes a medium special. So while he's not like somebody that I particularly enjoy, my favorite Ghibli film is not a Miyazaki work. It's a Takahata film, Grave of the Fireflies, which I think that is actually a film that I think is really accessible to everyone. It's not anime. It's set in World War II. About two young boys affected by the bombing of Nagasaki. So I would check that out if I were you guys. Very good film.
Okay, interesting. All right, you know, going around. Well, we haven't talked actually in a little while. So just for my audience, how are you doing? How's everything going? I mean, I've chatted with you via Twitter on and off over the last few weeks, but I mean, how's everything going? We were talking before. I know you're kind of feeling the funk, but you're healthy and you're doing well for the most part.
Healthy, doing well. I miss outside. I miss the sun. I miss my friends. I miss bars. I miss just driving. I miss pumping gas. I miss just the daily idiosyncrasies that make up this thing called life.
You must be one of the few people that just hasn't left the house, as much as you probably could or should. I mean, there are people that are fully functional as far as going out. Like my wife is going out to work every day. She's in healthcare, so she kind of has to, but for the most part, that has been our normal. But I mean, for you, you seem like you've been confined to the house for the most part.
Mom's really at risk, so we're trying to keep it safe out here in the Navas household. I am not working. COVID has decided that plans processing is not very important right now. Job inspecting, civil sites, not really a lot going on in those fronts. So I am not really working, so a lot of free time on my hand. I haven't left the house, so it's very welcome to talk Heat. I miss basketball. I miss other people's voices.
Nice. I can imagine. So should Dan Marino unretire his number 13 for Tua?
Listen, we have reached the bottom of the barrel of sports topics. We have reached number sports talk.
Yeah, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, I know the suggestion was kind of half-assed, and in this era, it's mostly kind of just a troll, but it's just ridiculous. I don't understand why we're even discussing this at all, but it's going around South Florida sports. And I know a large swath of my listenership is from South Florida, although we do have some international listeners for whatever reason. So I don't know how much, they're plugged into the whole Miami Dolphins versus Miami Heat, current state of affairs, but that's
discourse.
We're just pitting one sport against the other for no reason within the same fan base, more or less. So it's ridiculous. How do you feel about the Disney World situation? Are you ready to go to Orlando to watch NBA basketball?
No, I think that's such a bad idea. I want us to be safe and healthy. I want this to pass. I don't know, man. I don't get what the league is doing. I guess you really want to try your best to get the product out there. I just don't think it's wise. I don't think it's going to happen. I think they're floating. I think they're going to float a lot of ideas around. And I don't think they're really going to get anywhere. It seems like too much pie in the sky.
shout out to Keith Smith of Yahoo Sports, though. He was the original proponent of that idea, at least in a piece he wrote a few weeks ago. And he
Brian's been saying that since like the day the season ended. Brian's like, you know, we can just Brian, my co-host at Miami Heat Beat, he's like, you know, we can totally do this with the worldwide.
Well, he's from Orlando, right?
Yeah. So he's been peddling that forever. And I go, Brian, stop! It's not gonna happen. And he's like, been sharing this news nonstop in the group chat. So he's
well, it makes sense. No, it makes absolute sense. I mean, look, they host the Junior NBA tournament there. So there's already a working relationship with the ESPN, you know, Worldwide Sports Zone or whatever. They know how to air these kind of games. They have their existing partnership there with Disney, with TNT, et cetera. It just makes a whole lot of sense. And
that
to have all these hotels.
Something that I thought was probably the best argument against that.
Okay.
If we're going to do this, right, they're going to have doctors on staff, right? They're going to have doctors on the ground for this NBA tournament or whatever they're going to do. Zach Lowe was saying, is it smart to take doctors away from people that actually need them because we want to watch basketball? Like, is that really what we should be doing? Shouldn't we have all hands on deck at our healthcare facilities for people that need it, not for millionaire athletes who were just trying to provide an entertainment service? And he talked about the optics of that. And I don't think that's a small thing.
No, I think you started to see kind of similar brushback already when you were wondering why the Brooklyn Nets were able to get testing so far ahead of everybody else and things of that sort. So I think the league is sensitive to how they're viewed.
Recently in the news, yeah. Forgetting that. Like, I don't think the league wants to step in that kind of stuff. Like, them being in the news right now for those things, I don't think is something that they want.
All right. Yeah. Well, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't think that the season is going to restart anytime soon. I just don't see how
you
it's possible.
Under duress, because I've thought about this, like, would I want this? And I don't know if I'm good. I don't know if I'd want this. Like, you're gonna have guys not having played professional basketball in a long time. Like if you're an older player, like LeBron is somebody who's a well-oiled machine. I don't know if LeBron can just pick up a ball and like without preseason or warm up or anything. And like he took a whole season to really get into rhythm. And especially, like, you know, you look at the Raptors, a lot of veterans on that team, like, you know, that were playing really, really well. Like, they're going to, what, start a season under duress? What if they kind of, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of stuff that I'm not particularly fond of just, like, trying to pick this up and starting as fast as you can. Like, I'm kind of in the camp of I want just the season to end and then we'll figure out a 2020-21 season.
That's fair. I mean, I'm kind of there, too. I just want things to return to normal, and I know that's very unrealistic. And that's,
me too.
It's just, I mean, I don't think anybody saw this coming, like a 2-month hiatus on our lives, and not just, you know, the simple joy of watching basketball or being able to, you know, go to work and things of that sort, but just, I mean, the very real impact on our health and on a daily basis. That's something that nobody expected, and I certainly don't think anybody wanted that. So. I just want some kind of miracle to happen and for the last 6-7 weeks to be fully erased and us to be in the middle of a playoff push, but that's not going to happen. So let's kind of stay positive then, because we're here to look at some of the best moments in Heat history. It was a theme for the whole network, so every show for every fan base was doing something similar. There's no exact rules or format, and I didn't attach any to this show or any kind of subsequent show. It's just the 10 best moments in franchise history, purely subjective exercise, a fun one, I think, but just for the sake of keeping things somewhat more relevant, I arbitrarily designated that all 10 moments should be from the post-Riley era, beginning midway through 1995. Anything prior to that just seemed unnecessary. You could make a case for the team's first, appearance in the playoffs or their opening season, but I don't think most of my listeners go that far back. And there isn't really much to break down from those 6 seasons anyway. Do you agree, disagree with that take?
I kind of agree. Like, and I think you're going to see a lot of that on my list as well, kind of what I feel are the important eras of Heat basketball.
That's fair. I look at those first 6 years, and I tried talking myself into it. I was not a fan of basketball or the Heat at that point in time. You probably weren't even alive at that point in time. So
1992, baby.
Okay, so you got to witness, I guess, the team's first playoff appearance, maybe somehow from your crib, I guess. But either way, Your family, from what I recall, you telling me they were not basketball fans, right? They're football fans, soccer fans.
Soccer fans. Dad's right. Colombian, and this was a Pibe Valderrama household. My mom's Italian, dad's Colombian. So it was all soccer, always. It was Italian national team. It was Colombian national team. My dad tried to get me to adopt the U.S. national team. Worst decision he ever made. I don't like them. They bother me. I wish I was a Colombia fan.
The women's team, though, you do like.
I'm all about the women's team. I'm glad. Because, like, women's soccer was that's that my dad grew up with. I was like, huh, these games are good. They're awesome. I like them. Wow, this very tall Abby Wambach person, really freaking cool. I like her.
Is she tall? I don't know how tall she is.
She's tall, yeah. Flex, having stood next to her and talked to her in interview settings, she is quite the tall person.
Yeah, but you said the same thing about me. How tall is tall for you? Because you said the same thing about
me. She's like probably, I'd say she's a little taller than Spo.
So about 6'1", 6'2"?
About, yeah.
That is intimidating. I mean, that's one of the largest women in professional soccer, I would imagine.
Honestly, she's more scary to talk to than, like, Dwayne. It's not intimidating. Dwayne is, like, kind of cuddly. Abby's, like, kind of scary to talk to.
I don't know about all that. Dwayne's
very inviting. He's a very, like, nice person in the locker room. He's, like, he's nice. He's inviting. He doesn't. I don't know. He's even after losses, he's like a cool dude. He's like really chill. I don't know. You disagree?
I've never
seen Dwayne combative. Like I've never been around in a media setting where I've seen him combative. I know he can be combative if he's in a bad mood, but I've never really seen that.
You know, the first time I got a chance to talk to him one on one actually was shameful. Maybe my long term listeners remember. But he was actually coming out of the restroom in Orlando for the first inaugural Junior NBA World Championship. And he was coming out of the basketball. I actually tracked him down so he could come out of the basketball and I started asking him questions about basketball and his participation with the Junior NBA.
Was it nice? Was he scary?
No, he was perfectly a nice human being.
Pat's scary. Yeah. Even at like U Health events, Pat's scary. I don't like talking to Pat. It's a lot for me.
It's you get used to it, right? I think Jimmy's an interesting character. I think he's kind of approachable, to be honest with you, just because he's so direct. Like he's just going to tell you what he thinks all the time, and I like that about him. So
I haven't talked to Jimmy. I've not been in the locker room this season, but he's somebody that would scare me.
I just find him to be very direct. Like I know he plays the same games as everybody else in the locker room, kind of. Testing to see whether or not he's actually going to be available, trying to wait as long as possible so that, you know, all the crowd thins out so that there won't be many people there. And, you know, he's going to get that scrum around his locker
just
regardless.
Ethan at the end. Ethan sticks around.
He's been there. Alf's been there a couple times too, you know, so
Alf doesn't ask questions. Call him out. I know Alf. Alf's not out here asking questions. He's in the back of the scrum while you and Anthony and Ira pull weight.
No, nobody can get a question in there over Ira though. He's the first former.
Ira's the box out king. Ira is an artist. Ira Winderman is, I've never seen anything like that. He is a master at his craft, and I am in awe every time I'm at an event with Ira, because that dude comes so prepared. He's like rat-a-tat-tat, and he like has everything ready. He has his follow. It's like he anticipates what they're gonna say and has the follow-up ready. It's amazing.
Yeah, no. Yeah, and he also has the timing down pat. Like he knows exactly when a response is at its end, so that he can get that question in there right away before anybody else.
He's a professional. He's like watching Dennis Rodman rebound.
Dennis Rodman of interviews. There you go. That's exactly right.
Science. Shout out to Ira.
Okay. Well, you are the guest on the show, so let's move forward. What's your 10th most impactful moment in Heat history?
So I went with a regular season moment, and I don't have many of these on my list, because the Heat have had a lot of postseason success, and I went really specific. I went with the Dwayne Wade, game winner in the 2008-2009 season, against the Bulls. The, steal on Salmons, Wade puts it up for the win, and then he gets on the scorer's table, and this is my house. I don't really like putting regulars, because in the end of the day, that was a meaningless regular season game that even though they won, it doesn't mean anything. It was a snapshot of Dwayne's dominant season that did not really get to have a deep playoff run. They went 7 against the Hawks. They were out, had a really young team around him, Beasley, Chalmers, first year of J.O., you know what I mean? It's a James Jones, Daquan Cook, right? So really young team, inexperienced, and it was his best season. It was one of the most dominant seasons ever, and watching that unfold, that was the snapshot of that moment in time of Heat basketball, of the Dwayne Wade is arguably one of the three greatest players in the world. It was Wade, Kobe, LeBron, at least in my opinion. That was kind of the list at the time. And that's going to be the statue, I think. I think whenever Dwayne's going to get his statue outside of the AAA, I think that it's going to be the this is my house. That MV3 season really means a lot for Dwayne's career and where he played. I think, honestly, if he does not have that season, I don't think we look at him the same. That was his highest ever finish for an MVP ballot. I think he got the second most first place votes. It was after him or Chris Paul that season. I don't remember who. And that game, that moment was a snapshot of all of that, of his excellence at the height of his powers.
This is one of the issues that we were kind of going back and forth about when I talked to you about coming on the show, is these kind of specific moments and how they would fit into the overall narrative of a franchise. I mean, that's hard. It's not even like we're talking about the Boston Celtics or the Lakers or any other more storied franchise, but even within the 30 years of Miami Heat history, there's still a lot to talk about and break down. And yeah, this might be a very specific moment, but it encapsulates a lot of what Dwayne Wade represents, what he represents for this franchise, and his own personal legacy. So that is interesting. I don't know that I wanted to go into anything so specific there, but you make a good case as to why that's such a fun moment in Heat history and Dwayne's personal history too, is that, you know, he was the face of the franchise. He was one of the best players in the league. And I think it's easy, you know, to your point, as far as what that season represents, like, this was also in context of him being already crowned as an NBA champion. Like, at that point in time, like, we already know his legacy is already established. He's already one of the best players in the league. He's already one of the, won a championship. He's a, you know, a player capable of pushing you to perennial contention status. And I think that really kind of cements it. Why that specific shot? Just because of the energy involved in
it? Because of the snapshot, because of the moment. It was the most excellent thing I've ever seen him do on a basketball court. Actually, the most excellent thing I've ever seen him do on a basketball court is such a weird play. It's the block he had on Tyson Chandler in 2011 finals, where he was behind the play, somehow recovers, catches up, blocks Chandler at the summit, and then goes cross court for a dunk. That's the most incredible thing I've ever seen him do. But up to the point of 2009, the most incredible thing he has ever done on a basketball court was that. That was the moment, I think even more than the Varejao dunk that came next season. That was just like, that season, it really felt it was Dwayne Wade can do anything. And Eric Reed constantly called him Superman. Cause it felt that way. It felt that this guy can make anything happen, that he could make wine out of water.
Wow. And that might be pushing it just a little bit.
It felt that way, man. Listen, it felt that way. And that team was not that good. That team was filled with a bunch of really young players, and teams with a lot of young players tend to not do well. And that guy pushed them on their back to almost a 4 seed, a 5 seed, and was just doing stuff like that every single night. The bloody lip against New York, the shot, the dunk on Varejao for like 2 or 3 years. It was everything was that. And that's coming off of the 15-win season, winning, getting second in the lottery, right? It was kind of like Dwayne can't stay healthy. There was a lot of doubts if he could even play like for long stretches of time. And it was his comeback like, yeah, I'm this good. Like, I may have been hurt, but I'm one of the best players in the league. And he played in Miami, and that was really cool for the franchise and for the fan base.
I don't know if we've ever talked about it, but I know he's mentioned it before, and I think especially in context of his recent retirement ceremony and everything else. You know, those 2 years were kind of quote-unquote wasted seasons because they did not surround him with a lot of talent. Do you feel like they did waste those first and foremost? And then secondly, was that waste worth it knowing what would come from 2010 to 2014?
Hey, I was going to say, like, they had a plan, right? Their plan was always 2010. It was a cap space. I mean, they almost nuked it for Lamar Odom. Let's not forget. They were very close to signing Lamar Odom, and that would have ruined. And Lamar decided he was going to stay in LA to stay with his wife, Chloe, at the time. So this whole thing almost got nuked. by Lamar Odom. But the plan was, I think Riley sold the plan to Dwayne. I know Dwayne was not really happy about it because they could not get out of the first round. But he was like, hey, listen, we're going to have cap space and we're going to go after these guys. And obviously Dwayne really worked trying to get LeBron and Chris here and or whatever. And Amari Stoudemire was also in play.
It's so interesting. Like when you look at the Knicks putting all their eggs in that basket to try and get KD and Kyrie Irving, then falling short, they, you know, remain a laughing stock. It could just as easily have happened to Miami in 2010. Like they could have gone elsewhere.
Bosch gets the clots early. Imagine if Bosch got the clots early. Imagine if Bosch got the clots in year one.
That's a whole other story. I mean, I've
never thought about that until just a second, but just like imagine if Bosch's health gets nuked. Because essentially the Knicks got nuked by Amari's knees. Amari was an MVP caliber player that year in New York and his knees just completely gave up on him.
Yeah.
And in a way, Dwayne's body quit on him too toward the end of the big 3 years.
Yeah, no doubt. I don't know, man.
And maybe you could make the argument that they could have gotten more out of Wade's prime, because really Dwayne's prime had basically from 2007 to 2010, right? Like an albatross of nothing mattering, right? You had the 15-win season, you had the really lame title defense, and then you had those 2 years of the Dwayne show, and then back in 2000 when LeBron came or whatever. So I guess you can make the argument that if they could have sped up that process, but I really think that they felt that they could get two whales plus Dwayne. So
right. So in the statue, then, to your point, does he wear the jersey that says El Heat on it?
I think they're probably not gonna do. No jersey. Maybe they just go Heat. I want them to do El Heat. When Dwayne hit the game winner against the Warriors, I wanted him. I think I even tweeted the day he got the braids. I go, I need him to have an iconic game winner with the braids, so that we have to replay this highlight forever and ever and ever.
Did he have the braids at that point for the Warriors game winner?
Babe, Braid Wade.
Wow.
It's the best part of that. All the graphics, all the I have the Moments shirt. I have the Moments t-shirt with Dwayne and the braids. Braid Wade, man.
Oh, that is, not good. I don't know. I never liked that look in particular, but that's just me, I guess.
Q Rich made fun of him. I talked to Q Rich about that and he was kind of making fun of Dwayne for the braids, which is excellent. I love Rich, man. One of my favorite players ever.
Just a bunch of actresses, right?
That's my favorite team ever.
2009-2010.
That's my favorite all-time Heat team. It's the most fun I've ever had watching basketball.
Even more than the Big Three era?
I just loved it. There was a childish wonder about how much I loved the sport, and that team was just so fun, and I loved every single person on that team, and I loved how scrappy they were. I loved how they were so undermanned every single night, but it didn't matter. I remember weird stuff like Q Rich hitting a wing three against the Lakers, having 25 points, hitting like 8 of 9 from three and an overtime win. Like that team was so fun.
I remember having feelings like that about the 2003-04 team, like Dwayne's rookie season and with Lamar and Caron Butler and an older Eddie Jones and Brian Grant, et cetera. But not that 2009-10 team. Like, I mean, that was
very clear take I have. I also think that team could have made the conference finals had they not had Jacobo Diawara not banked in a three the last day of the regular season against the Nets in the second overtime. I feel very strongly about this.
That is very specific. I doubt that's going to make your top 10 list either. So, let's move on because we could probably go on.
What's on Heat?
All right. So for number 10, pretty subjective. I've talked about it a lot on the show, but for me, re-signing Chris Bosh in 2014 was, the 10th biggest moment for my understanding of my
Chris. Is Paul Deng number one?
No, he's not number one. Although I think it's.
At Riley said it was the most important free agent signing in Heat history.
Yeah, that's kind of ridiculous. But, I mean, I think we know why he did it. But just, like, I'll never forget that day. I think, and I've said it before, it was the lowest of lows and the highest of highs, all within the same day, because we find out that, you know, LeBron is going to Cleveland. And, you know, everybody remembers this. And you probably remember it better than most, but just the whole tracking, what was going on, and people's barbers.
The hexagonal color code.
Yeah. I mean, all the little details, tracking the planes and everything else. I mean, I was as emotionally involved as anything, you know, during that summer.
It was the best. It was the height of sports and nothing was getting played. It was heroin. It was so good.
It was exhausting though. Like, I mean, refreshing your Twitter feed every 5 seconds to see if you get an update. I mean, I remember being on the phone with my brother-in-law. We were just talking about something completely unrelated and like I refresh and there I see fucking Lee Jenkins talking, you know, his latest post, you know, my SI.com exclusive. I was like,
God, that's a moment that I think every Heat fan knows where they were when that news came out. It's like, you know, when you talk, oh, I you know, I knew where I was during 9/11 or whatever. Like, yeah. There are certain events, certain moments in people's lives. I know exactly where I was and I remember exactly who told me. Producer for WQAM, Alex Solana, my good friend from FIU, texted me, did you see the news? And I took a break from the internet, cause I was designing Miami Heat Beat's new homepage. And, yeah, I had to rewrite a lot of stuff after that. Let's put it that way.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that was painful, but you know, then to my point, then all of a sudden we get the good news that Chris is re-signing with the team. And, you know, I recall he was on the Chris Bosh Family World Tour. I believe
yes,
he was
on camels.
Yes. He was in Ghana. And then we had heard these stories about him, going back and forth with the Houston Rockets. And there was a very, very good chance he was like 95% sure that he was going to sign with the Rockets and get a max contract there. And then all of a sudden he re-signs in Miami. And you know, I just compared to, I don't want to say LeBron was ever abrasive or anything like that, but he was always a little more aloof. Like just something about Chris always felt much more personable. He was just friendlier with media, much more open, much more vulnerable, I think, in many ways than LeBron ever was. And so for him to re-sign there, bringing some humanity back to the franchise, just the opportunity for him, at least how it was envisioned by me and many others, that he was going to become a co-star with Dwayne. I was excited about that opportunity. And I remember feeling relief, like almost like this incredible amount of joy and knowing that he was coming back to the team. And I think that's where my fandom really ended from that point forward. Like from that moment,
the fandom died in David Rebell.
No, it really is. Like I never really invested myself emotionally past 2014 because I was broken from LeBron and then brought back to life by Chris's re-signing. And from that point forward, I was a little bit more detached from the whole thing. And that's okay. That's just my own personal journey with the basketball. But at the same time, like I just remember feeling like it was such a great moment for the franchise. It kind of just, it reestablished the franchise as a legitimate, not championship contender, but playoff contender at the very least. I mean, they had a good chance. I mean, they made that trade for Goran Dragic. If everybody had stayed healthy, if he had stayed healthy, do you think they could have won a title in 2014 or 2015 rather, or at least competed for a title?
So the year they went to the conference finals, the year that they almost went to the conference finals, they lost game 7 against the Raptors. That team, if you remember, I think they were 3-1 against Cleveland in the regular season, rather convincingly.
Yeah.
Like that was a really good team that could do a lot defensively. I don't know if they would have won the title, but I do think that had Hassan not gotten hurt, I think it's kind of unfair to say what happens if Chris stays healthy, because that's a lot of ifs. The Hassan thing was kind of a 4-game swing where he went down and Justice had to play center in Toronto, right?
I remember that.
Yeah. I think that I looked at it recently, like the center, the minutes distribution at center was ridiculous. It was like Winslow played the bulk of minutes at center and Haslam, and then it was like spot minutes for random people. It was not a very good look for them. They were decimated by injuries that season. And
I remember writing before that series against the Raptors that I thought Whiteside, based on his regular season play, I thought he was going to mop the floor of Valanciunas. That was probably
kicking his ass though.
But how is that possible? Like, I don't understand that. Like, just looking at that matchup, it does not make any sense to me. Like, it's not like Valanciunas was spotting up for three at that point in time. Just going physically, you know, against Whiteside, you would have thought that Whiteside would be able to dominate that matchup, and unfortunately that was not the case.
I think Hassan was scared of fouling Jonas, because Jonas is a really physical center, and I think Hassan was really getting over the I'm fouling too much thing, and he really had gotten out of it. I think people don't give Hassan enough credit for figuring out a lot of things that we were mad at him for. He really never figured out the passing down here, but like, remember, he used to be a foul machine, and he really cleaned that up. He used to block Hunt, and he really cleaned that up. So the fouling, that was the year that he really kind of tied up those loose ends, and Valanciunas came in really physical. more of a veteran than he was, really came energized, and I thought it really put Hassan on his ass. But when they both went down, Toronto was more equipped to go small. They had more guys than Amir Johnson. They had like these guys that were more ready to play this style of basketball than Miami was, and that still went 7.
What are your recollections of the Bosch re-signing and the context for this exercise?
I remember thinking that he was gone. It made too much sense to me. I was like, well, why wouldn't he want to go to Houston? And when he came back, it was like, lifer, dude, lifer, loyalness. And it felt good. It felt good because at that moment, it felt like, okay, Chris Bosch is one of ours. Like from this point on, and we were right. From this point on, Chris is our guy. Like Chris has cemented himself as our guy. We matter. We are going to go. It really felt like, okay, we are going to take up arms against LeBron. We're going to do what Cleveland could not. LeBron left Cleveland. They fell apart. That's not going to be us. We are going to raise an army. We are going to raise the resistance, and we're going to go at the king that left his land. That's what it felt like. And it felt really cool.
Yeah. And I'll say it. I still believed in the Josh McRoberts signing.
Me too.
Even knowing now what I do, I thought it was a great move by Raleigh. I was like, wow, he's going to be the next freaking Boris Diaw alongside LeBron James.
Bam is what we thought Big Bob's would be.
Yeah.
I thought Big Bob's would be Bam. One of the 3-point shot. I thought that. I remember pulling up stats. I was like, look at the defensive rating with Bosch and McRoberts on the floor. Look how good it is in like a 50-minute sample.
God, never quite worked out that way.
Never worked out.
I wonder what he's up to. I have not seen him in the public eye. He's probably just like retreated completely. I mean, he got his buddy and he's probably happy somewhere outside of the game.
I think that's one of the more fascinating, not to take up more time, but like one of the most fascinating stories of the Yips ever. Like that just kind of happened and he just...
I don't think it was Yips. I don't think it was Yips.
No, buddy. There was like, he fundamentally would not shoot in a way that was like Ben Simmons-esque.
Maybe.
He was Ben Simmons before Ben Simmons.
I heard some scuttlebutt from the other reporters that the franchise had kind of just gotten really pissed off at him because he had too many interests outside of basketball. And obviously that's not going to play very well in Miami. And, they were just very frustrated with him as a player. They wanted to jettison him as quickly as possible and they couldn't find any takers until Dallas, right? He was traded to Dallas and then eventually waived. I can't recall.
With the second, they gave him a second round pick with him.
That's right. That's right. All right. Good times. Well, those are our top 10 moments. We'll go down to some additional moments coming up next. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Well, I want to take this opportunity to tell you all about Blinkist. It's one of the most useful apps on my phone. It's hard to find time, even now with the coronavirus, to sit down and read and learn anymore. But, you know, when you don't have free time and you can't read or work on personal development, that's where Blinkist comes in. It's an incredible app that solves this problem, and I highly recommend it. Basically, you have access to all sorts of different types of nonfiction books. You can access it on your phone, your tablet, your web browser. It takes the best key points from every book, thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down to just 50 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people are well known for reading a lot of books. Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute, your lunch break, or whenever you're exercising or stuck at home doing something else or listening to this podcast. You can take a break and listen to Blinkist instead. 12 million people are using Blinkist right now and has a massive and growing library from self-help, business, health to history books. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestsellers lists as well as the classic nonfiction titles you always meant to read but never had the time to. Make sure you download Blinkist today. All right, we're back, taking some time here to go through the top 10 impactful moments, biggest moments. It's also subjective, and there are so many great moments there. You and I were talking about it before. We thought we could get into specific game-related moments. You brought up one for your top 10, your number 10 specific moment there. But I think there's a context to it, a narrative there. But I'm curious to see what your other list includes. So what's your number 9 as far as your list is concerned?
So I kind of waffled, and I actually changed this last minute. because nice. I put more of a personal one at number 9, and then I went more big picture. Like, I went more what's impactful for the franchise, not really. Number 9 was more of a me thing. It was like, it was Dwayne's first game back when he was a Bull. That meant a lot to me, and I know it meant a lot to the city, but it didn't really fit the context of what we're doing.
Okay.
So I went with the trade for Alonzo in 95.
Wow. See, that I would have thought that would be a little bit deeper on the list there, but I see where you're going. I've actually got that on my list too. That is number 7 on my list.
Nice.
Yes, I'm curious, why did you have it at 9?
So I thought about having it higher, and the more like player specific stuff is going to be, obviously it's going to be Dwayne stuff. And I just think that the Dwayne stuff means more to the franchise and had more title implications. Which is why I kind of had it a little lower. The thing with Zoe that I wanted to put it higher was he was a foundational building block for the culture that Pat Riley wanted to install. And I'm kind of regretting putting it at 9 and not higher.
Yeah. When you say it like that, exactly.
It's the basis of everything they are. Like, right. Literally, the identity of Alonzo is he culture. And I know that for newer generation people, we're going to say Udonis is he culture. And Udonis is 100% he culture. But the one who laid that foundation was Pat and Zoe. And that was like Pat's big move here. And it was, and Zoe had years that he was, could have been an MVP candidate. I know the lockout season, had that not been a lockout season, the Heat probably run away with the one seed and Zoe could possibly win MVP and they don't get upset by the Knicks in round one. Like, there's a lot of alternative history between that lockout season and what actually happened. It just speaks for itself. Foundational move. I know people love Glenn Rice, and I know that was a tough pill to swallow. I know my colleague, Leif on Heat Beat, feels a lot of pain for Glenn Rice, but welcome.
Only jersey I've ever owned, Glenn Rice.
Glenn Rice is awesome, man. Glenn Rice would be awesome in today's NBA.
Great story. I've never told you, but I've shared it before for our listeners. I was drunk off my ass in Coconut Grove at one point, leaving Tavern in the Grove. I don't know if you've ever been
there. Nice!
It's a hole in the wall, smashed, and Glenn Rice was walking around with his wife, Christina Rice, known as Spanish Rice, according to Phil Jackson. She was very, very upset. It was like, I want to say it was like 1:30 in the morning, walking through Coconut Grove, carrying bags, and he was carrying her bags, and they were like shopping late at night for whatever reason. And I came up to him, and I was really smashed, and I just had to tell him how much I loved his style of play. This was after he had already been traded away from Miami, and
he probably appreciated that.
He did. He smiled. He smiled about it. She was pissed off, but it seems like she was often pissed off about everything. But either way, that was my first interaction with Glenn Rice there. That was pretty hilarious. I think a lot of the Alonzo, or why you have him ranked at 9th, may have something to do with your age, the fact that you weren't there, that you weren't there in the moment. Because, you know, going back to why I didn't include the first 6 years of the franchise, it's because that franchise was such an amorphous blob. Like there was no identity for those first few years. Like, you had Ron Rothstein just basically watching, you know, the kids and making sure that they got out there and didn't hurt themselves or anybody else. There was no real structure there. Then you had Kevin Lowry kind of going in there to try and instill some of the culture that didn't develop until years later. He got fired, replaced by Alvin Gentry. But, you know, you had Ronnie Cicely, you had Glenn Rice, you had Grant Long, you had Steve Smith, but they were complementary role players for the most part. Even Glenn didn't really achieve all-star status until after he left Miami. But with the acquisition of Pat Riley and then that first move to acquire Alonzo Mourning, hell, that was just like, that was legitimizing the franchise in a way that nobody saw coming. Like, I don't think there was a lot. Maybe I was not as active like scouring the news or anything like that in 1995, but there were not a lot of rumors about, you know, Miami's interest. There was no Twitter. There was no Woj bombs being dropped weeks in advance saying, you know, we're on the cusp of acquiring Alonzo. You woke up the next day, you got the Herald, and there it was on the front page, 1A, you know, Miami against Alonzo Mourning. And that's as exciting a moment as you can possibly imagine for a young basketball fan. And so I think for a franchise, it was such a seminal moment there. And I was just kind of going over some of it because, to me, again, it wasn't much more impactful probably than you. But, you know, he had initially blocked the trade because he was worried that Miami's roster was going to be stripped down too much. They wound up giving up Rice, Khalid Reeves, Matt Geiger, and a first-round pick in exchange for Zoe and Pete Myers, who, you know, then he played a little bit, but he was mostly just a retread wing player at that point. He didn't even start at center. Like, his first game, he was starting alongside Kevin Willis. I had totally forgotten all this. They acquire him in November 3rd, and then November 4th was the season opener. So a lot later than the, you know, current season's opening. Like, he was there, like, they acquired him the day before, and he was in a jersey the next day playing their home opener. That was pretty impressive stuff.
And they got Timmy midseason too. So, like, that was such a fun year. That was also the year that and I know that's been in the news lately, when Miami won against the 72 Bulls off Dan Marley.
Yes. It was that trade, clearing off that roster to acquire Tim Hardaway and everybody else. And so there was
I've asked some older Heat heads, what was more fun? And I feel like they're comparable. That game or the Dion Warrior game? Because they're like the same thing, right? It's taking a win off of the record-setting team shorthanded in quite spectacular fashion.
I love Dion. I think anybody knows that. But I think, at least again from my perspective, like, it wasn't a lot of talk about the South Beach flu or any of that shit, or the fact that Jordan played, 48 rounds of golf the day before or the day of. I mean, none of that seemed to matter. Like the Bulls were so indomitable. I mean,
so were the Warriors. The Warriors won 73 games that season.
I guess you're right. I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Maybe it is.
There's something fun there. There was something. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think that they're neck and neck. I just think that it's closer than people. I think right off the bat, people are going to say, oh, are you kidding me? The game against the Bulls. And then when you really think about it, you're like, I don't know, man. That was like the linchpin of 30-11. It was kind of a magically wonderful, weird time. And I don't know.
Yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense. I mean, but back to Zoe, though, you just can't get past how important that was to acquire a legitimate superstar. And even then, I mean, you think about the reality of acquiring
the perfect superstar for this franchise.
That's fair.
It had to be him.
That's fair. I don't think anybody else would have bought into it as much. I mean, we look back now, and the reality is that Riley would have burned out his tenure in New York anyway. He burnt himself out of Los Angeles. A lot of people kind of tend to forget he was kind of pseudo fired. Like, they basically said, we're going to bring in somebody else's coach, Mike Dunleavy Sr. And Riley was kind of forced to take a job as a broadcaster. But, he had time, you know, he had started to alienate Magic and everybody else in that roster. Kareem was retiring. You know, it was a whole different team. They didn't want to have anything to do with Riley and his manipulations. And so for Zoe, being a young player, you know, entering his fourth season in the NBA, it was so important for him to have that right kind of mentor that would get the most out of him. And Riley was perfect for it. So yeah, it was a great move to acquire Riley, but then for him to get Zoe, like you said, the perfect player for this franchise, I think it was just such a special moment in the franchise. And now, although I have it at seventh overall, like, I still think it's, you know, it's Bears pointing out how monumental that moment was, and it was just a great time overall. I still got to get into my ninth one, because obviously Zoe's still ninth for you, although you can always change even mid-podcast. I've got signing Jimmy Butler as the ninth most important moment.
Interesting.
I just think you look at the last couple of years and you know, how, I don't want to say mediocre, but that's probably the accurate word for it. They were not
average. Yeah, I feel like average is a nicer way to say it.
Yeah, they maximized the talent and potential of the team. They had some conflicting personalities. They had a glut of, you know, positions there that didn't work out as far as everything else. But I mean, I really think that this team could have made some noise in the playoffs this year. Despite whatever that computer system is that's breaking down the playoffs. Have you seen that tweet? I don't know. Tim Reynolds tweeted out something like that. Sportomatic. Apparently we would have been down 3-1 to the Indiana Pacers at this point in time if we had met them in the playoffs. But either way, Jimmy, like, he seemed to cement something about this team that you know, that was missing over the last couple of years. As much as we appreciate Dwayne being a part of The Last Dance last year and everything else, that, you know, he is as important a figure in sports in South Florida as anyone, probably most important and more important than anybody else. Jimmy just, again, re-legitimized this franchise, gave it a structure that it was missing over the last couple of years, allowed everybody to kind of figure themselves out, have a much more clearly defined role. And I think the players really started to thrive. Like, I mean, I keep bringing this up, and I know it's not like a broken record, but to me, that locker room was as harmonious as one as I've ever seen. And it was, despite the fact that Jimmy's personality is supposed to be toxic and everything else, like, his competitive fire fits so well in that franchise. As much as we were talking about Alonso being perfect for this franchise, you'd have to put Jimmy there as well. Like, and I think the fact that he was willing to come here to, again, re-legitimize this franchise kind of serves notice around the league that the Heat were and are still a destination for a lot of players. And I think that's the first step towards acquiring a future or other additional superstar alongside Bam and Jimmy Butler. So,
to it's me, hard to judge, because it's still early. I don't know if this has title implications yet. And Jimmy would be, I think we're gonna have a lot of similar, like, for in terms of free agent and acquisition portions of this list. I think Jimmy's gonna be by far the worst player. Not a slight to Jimmy, obviously a great transcendent player, but I don't know if Jimmy's a 1A guy, right? I think that for this team to take the next step to be a contender of a championship team, either somebody on the roster has to become a 1A guy, or they have to get a guy better than Jimmy Butler. So that's kind of where I have my, like, I'm not sure about that, but well, let's see how that plays out.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I mean, that's maybe a little bit more on the negative side there, but I don't know, something about, again, acquiring an established superstar, whether or not he's a 1A, those things seem to, like, semantics. I think even if you go back to 1995, like, nobody knew what Alonzo Mourning was. Like, he had been a really solid player, a potential all-star and things of this sort, but
I have more sample of what Jimmy is than what we had of Zoe. And Zoe had just led his team. I mean, like, and if we're being frank, I mean, Jimmy hasn't really done much in the postseason. Has he been out of round one once? Right?
As a
star, as, like, the guy, he's not been out of round one. When he was a role player on the Bulls, they got to round two. That was a Nazi Muhammad pushing series. Good times. they lost to Cleveland in round one, and the first year of LeBron's tenure.
When was the year of the big out? No, the three alphas, right? Him, they got past the first round there.
Did the him, Rose, and?
No, with Jimmy, Dwayne, and Rajon Rondo.
They lost in round one. They went up to nothing. And they came home up to nothing, and they blew it.
That's what it was.
I was mad at them because were they playing the Celtics? It was somebody.
I want to say it was the Celtics.
It was somebody that I didn't want to win, and I was like, "Why can't you guys hold the damn lead, you losers?" So bad.
Well, in context of, you know, Jimmy Butler being a potential foundational superstar, or at least a guy who is a, you know, secondary level superstar, my number eight seminal moment in Heat history is drafting Bam Adebayo in 2017.
Ooh, also too early to tell, but I like what you're doing here, David.
And what am I doing here?
I like it. Right. I see you.
Okay.
I hope he's listening.
I think he's going to be such a key figure for this franchise moving forward. I mean, all the talk about him being a Heat lifer, and he's even said that this past week, you know, all that is great publicity, PR, whatever. But the reality is, I think seeing him in Chicago opening eyes and seeing other superstars around the league, you know, the top 24 players in the league kind of be around Bam and have guys like Spencer Dinwiddie say how much, you know, he grew close to Bam during, you know, the time in Chicago and things. It's just, you know, one of the things that Wes and I always wondered about before was who was going to be the player in Miami who was going to recruit other players, who was going to get anybody else interested in making Miami a destination again. And there was no clear favorite there. Like, you know, clearly Josh. Well, I mean, it could have been Dion, but I mean, I don't know. I think his personality meshes with some players, but either way, like, it wasn't Josh. maybe it could have been justice because of the Duke connection, but I mean, he would have had to take such a leap as far as his overall playing ability is concerned.
We dubbed Justice the curator of culture when Dwayne retired. We thought that Justice was going to be the mantle carrier. We were wrong.
Yeah, it didn't quite work out that way.
Bad hours.
But it could be Bam. I mean, it looks like it's going to be Bam. And I just, to see his development take such a rise this year, and again, to be recognized as an all-star, just his fourth season. I mean, this is all trending in such a great direction for him that I think he is going to be that foundational piece that again brings the Heat towards a potential championship contention status.
I have the same opinion with Bam that I do with Jimmy. I think he's not the 1A guy. I don't know if he can be Jokic offensively. I think that the model that you look at is, can you be an, I think offense is more important than defense in this league, by the way. I don't know if I've said that too much publicly, but I think James Harden is kind of living proof of that. And the rules and just the systems just favor offense always. And I think more important than having, I think you have to have obviously a good defense and a good offense, but I do think as a great player, you really need to have an offensive engine that runs. And I think Bam is that. Bam is becoming a guy who is kind of greater than the system. He is an offensive engine, but I have questions about his shooting, and I do think that's going to be a limiter going forward. I think when they start playing big games, we're going to see how teams guard him, and I think that there's a lot of question marks in his game if he'll even develop them. I have no doubt that he will. I think Bam, by the way, is a good free throw shooter, and I think his shot form looks nice, and I have no doubt that he can develop a three-point shot with all the stuff we have now, but I have questions if he can be a 1A guy. I have questions if he can be a hub of an offense for a great team. Same I have of Jimmy Butler. And I know the Heat offense was very, very good this year. So that's kind of my trepidation with that stuff, is that it's a lot of I don't know yet.
My whole problem with the idea of a 1A player is that seems like a sub-narrative to the whole Michael Jordan thing. And maybe that's just in context of watching The Last Dance, but at the same time, like people criticized what his abilities were during the first few years when he wasn't winning shit. Like, I mean, he was just a glorified scorer that didn't do much else. Like, I mean, yeah, he had his defensive moments and everything else, but I think there was a healthy dose of criticism there that he was a selfish scorer on a bad team. And it's, if Harden didn't have Chris Paul the last couple of years, or Westbrook, or even Dwight Howard a few years ago, and he was just putting up those monster numbers, I think, I mean, he's still being criticized now, even with those other great players.
We're doing it now.
But I mean, imagine Harden on those teams without those complimentary star players. And that's what Jordan was earlier in his career when he wasn't able to win.
Everyone needs stars to help them, right? Like, and I think Bam is a star, like clearly, and I don't want this to come off as I'm saying, I think Bam is one of the, we've talked about this on Heebie all the time, like we think Bam is one of the best young players in the league. There's very few young players that take over Bam. List is on one hand. I think what he does as a big man is absolutely special and transcendent. Is he, you know, would I rather have Karl Anthony Towns? Yeah, probably, but that doesn't mean that I don't think Bam is like special and like has the ability to be something really, really great. So sure. I don't want people to like think that I'm saying anything that Bam's not like awesome, because he's 100% probably going to make an all NBA team this year, which is remarkable in his third year. And everything that he's accomplished.
All right, let's take a break here and we'll move on with our 10 big moments in Heat history. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On Heat on Himalaya, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're in iTunes, please leave a rating and review, especially if it's a good one. So I kind of cut you off a little bit when we were going through our top 10 moments in Heat history. I brought you my number 9 and 8. So now what's your 8th most important moment in franchise history?
It's Dwayne rediscovering himself versus Indiana in round 2 in 2012.
Wow.
It was – you say wow when you have signing Jimmy Butler.
Yeah, because I mean I don't – okay. No, I want to hear this because honestly, that doesn't even register for me. So maybe I'm like a bad fan or whatever, or a bad media person, because I don't even know at this point. Like I don't recall anything particularly standing out about that. So I want
really,
to hear your
explanation. I remember being frozen. I mean, it's either this or LeBron game 6. I think there's similar implications, right? Like it's a blueprint on the line. I thought it was Blueprint on the line down 2-1 at Indiana. Like, to me, that was, in that first quarter, was awful. That first quarter, they looked bad. Dwayne looked bad. Dwayne looked lost. The game before, it was this yelling at Spo. It was, it's all falling apart. Chris Bosh is hurt. This is going south. We're losing to a bad Pacer team. What the hell is going on? It was game six at Boston before game six at Boston. That playoff run was exhausting. And if Dwayne does not figure it out, nothing happens. Like, that's over. That's over. They're over. I mean, they were starting Dexter Pittman with LeBron, right? Like, there was a, they were very thin. The injuries made them very thin, and Dwayne's self-destructive play was throwing them in the toilet. He couldn't even make a layup. It was really, really bad. It was like LeBron in 2011, bad. And he was not healthy, and I don't know what he did. I don't know how he did it. And even to start game four, he looked bad. He hit a three that kind of got him going. LeBron got him a backdoor dunk toward the end of the half. And then from then on, Dwayne went on a freaking tear and absolutely dismantled and tore apart the Pacers and subsequently the Celtics, because he played very, very well in that series. He was torching them without Chris Bosh. And without – they were Bosh short. They were injury – they were like had injuries all over the court. They still did not know how to play with Battier at the four. That started – the day that they started Dexter Pittman, Battier slid into the four spot, and that was really the first time they started using that, and Spo has talked a lot about that. That was a lot for the franchise, and I put that over the games. I think game six at Boston is more like the moment, because it's like a singular moment of, oh, LeBron's like not going to lose, and it was kind of the higher profile guy. But if Dwayne doesn't figure that out in Indiana, I don't know where this franchise is right now. I don't know.
See, that's the context that I did not have. Like, maybe I'm misremembering or just didn't focus on that as much because it kind of glossed over with everything else that happened over those 4 years. And I was not covering basketball as religiously. I had a full-time job. I was married and I was not like,
you're trying to say, basketball. David.
Well, it was probably a little different. I mean, you were a young college kid at that point, probably.
Covering the league.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little different. And, I don't know. I don't remember it as importantly, but when you paint it with that particular brush, it does register for me. Like,
if
that resonates.
If round two against the Pacers, somebody's getting traded and Spoelstra's probably fired.
Without a doubt.
Bosh is probably the one that gets traded. Maybe Dwayne is untradeable because he looked like dog poop. Right. It was bad. Like, he looked completely immobile. He looked unhealthy. And the fighting on the sideline with Spo, it was bad. It was nasty. And I've heard other accounts talk about, like, what went on between the things that were said between Dwayne and Spo were not nice. And
like what? I have never heard anything. So
I don't feel like I'm at liberty to repeat it, but it was bad. And for Dwayne and Spo and LeBron to pull that together when, you know, my dad described, my dad was very scared of coronavirus before it happened. My dad has been on this since like fucking January. Am I allowed to curse? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, considering you just said dog poop 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, I did. I was very careful. I was trying to be, you know, my dad described our lives. He said, society is hanging by a thread right now. Right. And I call him an apocalyptic. Fun of. That's what the Heat felt like. They were hanging by a thread. The fabric of the franchise was hanging by a thread that was a tendon on Dwayne's knee. That was what was holding the entire franchise. Because if that doesn't go well, I don't think Jimmy's here. They might not. Maybe they pick Bam because they're in the lottery too many times.
No, but the whole franchise blows up. Like, everything changes. Like, I mean, you hang on to LeBron and he's stuck in a situation similarly to what happened in Cleveland. Like, now we have to figure out how to retool around him. What do you get back for Bosh? Like, I don't think you fire Spo, but
I think Spo's gone. I mean, remember the Batty thing in retrospect looks genius. Oh my God, Spo went small, started Dexter Pittman, Battier. Bro, we were like, why is this guy starting Dexter Pittman? Like, I don't know if you remember, there was like a different starting lineup every day, right? Yeah. And he looked like a guy who had no answers, who was trying to see what would work. It was not, the optics were not good. Like, I think everyone remembers game six at Boston being the moment because it's a more singular moment. This was like, they looked like not the Boston series, whatever. The Celtics won an overtime game in Miami when Miami was kind of in control, and that was a competitive series. This was like, why are the Pacers doing this? Who are these people? What, Roy who? Lance, like, Lance Stephenson wasn't even playing then. It was like, who are these people? It was bad.
Was Danny Granger the
Danny Granger was the guy. It was the Danny Granger led Pacers. And Paul George might have been a rookie or
second year player, I think. Yeah. Man, that's interesting. I did not remember it with that kind of context. So I'm interested to, I'm glad you brought that up because I'll have to go back and revisit that because honestly, I did not remember it being such a key moment. Maybe I just thought it was a foregone conclusion that they'd figure it out, but that really wasn't the case. Like, I mean, they were vulnerable. I mean, we kind of think of them as a powerhouse and certainly they were a very, very, very good team, but they were absolutely vulnerable. So do you think Riley would have stepped in and try and led LeBron and get the most out of them even at that point in time, or would he have hired somebody completely different?
I have no idea. Like, it was to the point that I don't know if Pat would have come back. Maybe that was what would have pushed desperation time because that's panic buns. That's like we have to rethink everything that we thought because we just went out in round two against a team that we were supposed to sweep.
Right. All right. Let's quickly get into your number seven there. We'll wrap up this show.
The Shaquille O'Neal trade.
Ooh. Wow. I have that one much deeper in my top five.
And the Pacer one is important because of the title implication. This is also the title implication. It's not just the title implication, but it was kind of Shaq came here as a 1A. I've talked a lot about 1A guys. Shaq came as the 1A, right? Dwayne had not become the 1A yet, right?
No.
Dwayne had the shot. That was also a contender for my list, the shot over Baron Davis, because that was the moment that Dwayne Wade became Dwayne Wade. But the getting of Shaq, I don't know if you know this, but the upper deck, that was built because Shaq got traded and they needed the extra attendance room.
I did not know that.
They built that because they're like, oh, we have Shaq now. We're going to have more people come. So they built that because they got Shaq. And they had didn't they have a parade when he came, when he was on the water gun and he promised the title? Like, that was.
It wasn't quite a parade. It was like a press conference on the steps of the American Airlines Arena. And yes, they had a podium.
It felt like a parade, David.
Yeah, it might have been. It might have been.
It was a parade and Shaq had the super soaker.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, it was kind of indicative of like, well, we recognize that the Alonzo Mourning era was somewhat of a failure, but we also recognize that we have this player in Dwayne that we have to find a way to maximize. And whether he's a 1A guy or a potential 1A guy down the road, remember, this is his second year. We still recognize that we need to partner him with somebody who has championship experience. And that being the case, you go out and you make acquisition for the best, well, not the best, the biggest player in the NBA at that point in time.
I would probably not be the best player. I mean, he was arguably the best player. I mean, he was, what did he come second in MVP voting in 2004, 2005?
Yeah, I guess. I think there was the.
That was his last, like, great year, right? Because in 2006.
I think the feeling was shifting a little bit whether or not it was him or Kobe who led those Lakers teams. That's how I recall it. I might be dead wrong there. I understand that. You could make a case depending on your stylistic preferences, whether or not you like his more perimeter-based game, or whether you like Shaq's, you know, drop step and whatnot. But at the same time, like, it just felt like it was different. And of course, you know, you remember the whole team that he left too, that the first super team with the Lakers with Karl Malone and Gary Payton and everything else like that. The fact that they were decimated by probably one of the most overrated teams in NBA history in the Detroit
Pistons.
They
were really injured too.
Yes, right. They should have won. Like, between the infighting, the fact that they had these two aging superstars in Malone and Payton, I mean, they should have been able to beat the Pistons. Somehow they did not. But yes. Like, it was just, I feel like there wasn't as much, there was something attached to Shaq's name there, but Shaq, the individual player, wasn't quite the same thing so much as Shaq, the legacy, Shaq, the superstar, Shaq, the, you know, the cross, you know, he was a star among the many different fields as a rapper, an actor, an entertainer. He was larger than life in so many different ways. And that's why I have it in the top five was because he brought something to Miami that no player had done. As much as Zoe was the workhorse that was the perfect tool for Pat Riley, Shaq was just larger than that. He was just so much more important. He was just such an established name and already, of course, a three-time champion at that point. So that was – you know, and thinking about the Shaq trade, I know you probably are aware of this, but maybe my listeners are not. The whole Anthony Carter to Lamar Odom process there. Like, I thought of making that a moment there. Can you imagine anything like that happening in today's Twitter field? Like,
oh my God.
Can you imagine, like, an agent not faxing? Of course, fax doesn't even exist now. I guess it would be DocuSign or something like that, but not faxing in saying, yeah, I want my client to get paid $10 million this year. And this is Anthony Carter. It wasn't like he was great. He was a decent role player, but it was like, who's maybe Goran Dragic in the last year of his contract, you know, his player not exercising the player option instead, and he just winds up becoming a free agent. But for Anthony Carter to not, you know, for his agent to not fax in that document, exercising the player option, then all of a sudden having this available cap space to sign Lamar Odom, and then having that great first year with Dwayne in 03-04, which again, this is why I think it was one of the funnest seasons in Heat history, with Stan Van Gundy as the coach and Caron Butler as a young up and coming player. Like, I mean, there was so much fun about that. Like, already there were no expectations. As many expectations as you had pinned on Alonzo Mourning and Brian Grant and Eddie Jones and Tim Hardaway before that, to all of a sudden have zero expectations and to make the playoffs and see this foundational superstar kind of come into his own, that was just such a fun year. But then to be able to trade Lamar to acquire Shaquille O'Neal, I mean, the Anthony Carter debacle probably deserves some nomination there. Like, I had it in my honorable
mention. It's an honorable mention.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy.
I think Lamar not coming here, it's not as funny, but I do think it had, like, the same level of impact.
In 2009?
Yeah, I think it's like those are two decisions that would have completely changed.
I was all for it at the time.
It would have changed the fabric. Imagine if Lamar Odom came to the Heat. I think the league is completely different. I don't think KD goes to the Warriors. I think that we're looking at a completely different NBA.
It's so hard to pinpoint those. I have one on my number six that I'll get into in our next episode. But my number six, as far as the key moments in franchise history, like, well, I'll tease you now. I'll tease it now. It's a Ray Allen shot. The Ray Allen shot. Like, to me, that
six?
Yeah, six.
You have it one spot ahead of drafting Bam?
No, seven for me was trading for Alonzo Mourning. Like, I mean, like, it was a special moment.
Jesus!
Well, to me, again, the it was a great individual play.
Transaction season. David's about the transaction.
Well, you think about the fact that you still had to win overtime, that you had already won a championship the year before, and that you still had to win game seven. It reduces the importance.
Look me in the face. And you tell me that you did not know that they were winning that overtime.
I did not.
You look me in the face that you were like, once they forced overtime, you're like, there's no way on God's green earth that they're going to lose this game. I felt at the time that these men will die on the court before they lose. I felt that in my damn bones that Chris Bosh would not let this happen.
I probably should have saved this story for when I actually talk about game six, but I'm kind of ashamed to bring it up. But I had a series of shirts that I would wear during the Big Three era playoffs. Like, I had t-shirts with all members of the Big Three. And then I had a specific shirt that I would wear during the finals that had the NBA Finals logo emblazoned on it. And I would wear that during the finals. Whatever. Cheesy, stupid shit that you do as a fan. And then the shirts I would wear, like, in succession. I would wear the Wade shirt first, then the LeBron shirt, then the Chris Bosh, and then kind of rotate them. And then I would hang them up, too. I would hang them up from my dresser in succession. Oh, yeah. She was totally in on it. She was like, oh, this is just crazy shit that Dave does. And, so she dealt with it. And then I also did not wash them. So a couple of them had, like, buffalo wing sauce on them. Whatever.
Come on, David!
Anyway, so the last 25 seconds of the game, you know, we're down, whatever. And I see the whole franchise falling apart. It was a mess. I go into the bedroom. I left the living room and I go into the bedroom, throw the shirt I was wearing, the NBA Finals shirt, throw in the hamper, take the fucking t-shirts off, not even off the hanger, I just throw them to the ground. I say, fuck it, they lost, it's over. I'm so frustrated and pissed off. And then I'm like, my wife's like, what happened? And I couldn't even talk about it. I was almost on the verge of tears. And then eventually, I realized, you know what? I can't do this. I can't. I've invested so much of my energy into watching them play. I've got to go back out there. And then I did.
What was the moment that made you do that? What was the moment that you quit?
Oh,
turnover? Was it the Chalmers turnover?
Yeah, it might have been. It might have been seeing, like, I kind of was like seeing through my fingers. Like I had my fingers over my eyes and I was kind of looking at them because I couldn't stare at the screen directly. You know, all the crazy shit that people do as fans. It was just too much for me to handle. Like it was like staring at the sun in the middle of a solar eclipse. I couldn't deal with it. So I just, and I realized later on, I was like, I have to be with my boys. I have to watch it. You know, whatever happens, you know, the captain goes down with a sinking ship and whatnot. And so I went back out there.
You tried to take on the lifeboat. David had the lifeboat ready.
I did. And I was one of those guys who left the arena and then changed my mind a minute later. And then so I came back and watched the final seconds of the game, and I ran back into the bedroom. I was like, it's back on. Tie game, overtime. Hung the shirts back up. Put the shirt
in the final back, section. Baby.
And watch the rest of it. So for me, like, it was a great individual moment, but I can't, I don't know. I don't know if I could put it in the same tier as everything else, but that's a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to hearing what your next six are, but that's it for today. You can connect with me on Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat or email me at lockdownheat@gmail.com. I'm David Ramil signing off and thanking you as always for your support.
Crack it up, dude.